if you do what you love, you'll never work a day in your life, right? Like that to me is like the most, like one of the most violent ideas ever. Actually, literally trains people in art school to expect exploitation. If you calculated an hourly wage for the average artist working with an institution, that average hourly wage is like £3. What I want you to understand about why it's good, quote unquote, that Not Nowhere is a queer POC cooperative is not just because queer and POC people are involved and included, quote unquote. Like anybody can include Black people in anything. It's like literally all you're doing is assimilating people into something that's gonna just basically help them learn how to subjugate others. Like I don't want that. But like, can you actually more aggressively redistribute to POC? Like with actual like hard money access and resources. But it always falls down at the point where that person who's trying to make those connections sees that their position is going to be sacrificed. Like, yeah, do something that's going to get you fired. You know, like literally sacrifice yourself because you believe that this redistribution thing has to happen.
Today's guest is Taylor Lamell. Taylor is one of the co-founding members of the worker cooperative Not Nowhere. Not Nowhere is an Arts Council-funded organization that educates about and lends out analog camera equipment. Not Nowhere is a queer and POC-led co-op, supporting people from marginalized groups to maneuver through the establishment and institutions of the British art world. By maintaining the analog equipment and art form, they explore capitalism's relentless pursuit of progress and creation of waste. Taylor, welcome to Punchcard. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thanks for having me. It's really fun to be here.
Nice. So, yeah, first question is, in your own words, what is a worker cooperative?
Oh my goodness. So I think a worker co-op, it's about worker control, where a laborer can explore a different type of relationship to hierarchy, to responsibility, to accountability, maybe even to their own sense of feeling around, yeah, what they spend most of their time doing. But I think what I've been like sitting with so much for the last few years is like, you know, this thing about giving workers control or workers kind of taking control, it doesn't actually end there. It's a way of mitigating this terrible problem that we're all in, where most of us are compelled to work, even though we know at the same time that the compulsory nature of work is also like really unhealthy for the body, for the mind, for the spirit, literally everything. So, for example, it's not that worker co-ops completely eradicate people being unhappy, right? It doesn't eradicate conflict, right? It doesn't eradicate people feeling tired at the end of the day. It doesn't eradicate people feeling burnt out. Oh God, this is so depressing. Creates a space where we get to damage ourselves and then talk about it. Oh, this is like incredibly psychedelic. I can't even answer this.
Psychedelic, love it. Well, yeah, from that then, let's move into, well, move backwards. So over your lifetime, what have been some of the experiences that you found kind of politicized you and led you to this point?
My mom, actually, when I was a kid, was running a kind of arts and community institution, which they had a small gallery. I wish it wasn't that small, but they had a gallery, which was a small aspect of the program. But let's say I would say probably like 95% of the footprint of that building was dedicated to like arts workshops of all sorts. So there were like painting classes, drawing classes, there were dance classes. Also at that time when I was a kid, like computers were a new thing. So there were like computer classes, there were like theater classes, like all this kind of stuff. And so I feel like in some ways I kind of like grew up in like, I mean, it would never be like spoken about in this way in that context, but I feel like I kind of grew up in a context of like art pedagogy. You get taught about these, let's say, famous artists, you know, like the ones that are in museums, right? Again, like this is the difference between like your aunt who likes to paint in her house on a weekend and like the guy that's at the National Gallery whose painting is like being meticulously preserved by like a whole team of professionals, right? And so like the thing that gets taught around what the difference is between let's say Van Gogh and your aunt, right, is because Van Gogh is a genius, right? Quote unquote, right? But actually, what I feel like that doesn't often get taught, and I'm talking about like, you know, to 12-year-olds, to 14-year-olds, to 17-year-olds, like this is really who I want to like hear this information, is that like someone like a Van Gogh, right? Or like many of these like kind of old masters would have been one of a few things, if not all of these things. One would have had their lives kind of maintained by a very rich patron, right? Which is a dynamic that maybe does still exist to an extent, but I don't feel like I really know anyone who's in that type of relationship, or would have come from incredible wealth, which I think is a conversation that's happening a lot, where actually we still do have a number of people who, or let's say a secret ingredient of who can actually withstand this £3 an hour labor relationship with an art gallery is someone who, what, does not need the money, right? Because they are being maintained by a wealthy family, right? And I feel like this aspect is like maybe a secret ingredient to be able to sit there and perfect an artistic technique, right? But also that leaves people very ripe for exploitation. I think especially in an art context, you kind of sell this idea, or you sell this idea to like basically kids, right? That like you should come pursue the arts because you love to draw. And like if you're just drawing all day, you will quote unquote never work a day in your life. And isn't that such an attractive idea? But there's this book by a group called the Precarious Workers Brigade, which is called Training for Exploitation, which literally talks about, you know, how actually the way that art schools teach or don't teach the kind of like economic machinations of how the art industry works actually literally trains people in art school to expect exploitation as something that they need to give in order to prove that they love what they do, right? Which would involve, for example, and there's like a more recent report. I think that book is from maybe like 2016 or something like this, but then there's a more recent publication that's also come out, which is called Structurally Fucked by a group called We Industria, which I think that report also came out of this idea where if you calculated an hourly wage for an artist, for the average artist working with an institution, that average hourly wage is like £3, which is insane. And I feel that the main reason why that has been allowed to go on is because of this myth that is very convenient, right, for the ruling class that actually you do art because you love it.
When was the moment when you kind of like clocked onto all of this stuff?
I mean, it was a few things. I think it was certainly moving to the UK from the States was like a very like wonderful experience to the extent that I felt like people here were, particularly in an art context, were much more like kind of openly critical and openly Marxist. I don't think that that's strictly speaking the case. You know, I don't think that that's really true. I think it's just more about like who I knew. And I think also the American context is like, it's very interesting because there's so little, if any, direct government funding for the arts, that it is actually much more, you have a much more compulsory relationship as an artist to like selling, whether it is selling work or selling yourself or being marketable or any of these things. Whereas it feels more possible in the UK to be an artist who doesn't want to sell objects than it had ever felt to me in America, right? You know, because we're talking about co-ops, we're also talking about my relationship to having a job in this industry, right? And first of all, when I started to work in this industry, I had three jobs, which were, did I have three jobs? I had two. No, I had two jobs, which were in the art industry, which were nominally paid. I think for one, basically my payment was a monthly Oyster card, which I then used to like sell to someone because I had a bike. And so then I was like, what was a monthly Oyster card at that point? Was it like £84 a month or something like that? Anyway, I was getting like £116 a month from one internship, one curatorial internship. And then from another one, I think I can't remember if I was getting £100 a week or £100 a month, even if it was £100 a week, right? We know that that's not enough to live on in London, even in 2013. Right. So even my own participation in this industry again was like I was having my own version of a kind of 1803 situation where my participation in this industry was being financed outside of the industry itself, right? literally through savings and through my parents' belief in that. I was like, I really want to do this. And they're like, we're going to like support you to an extent, right? And I was like I said, I was American. So I sold my car. I sold my car. I moved to London and I was like, this gives me this much time to figure this out. Not everybody can do that, right? So there was like an awareness of my own like ability to participate in this industry and like what enabled me to work unpaid in order to receive the credentials that you need to even be qualified or be seen as qualified to do paid work in the first place. But then once I did eventually become qualified to like have a salary job, and that's actually what I ended up on the curatorial team for like a film and performance department in an arts institution in London, right? And that was, again, I'm like, I'm used to the word psychedelic again. That was like an incredible experience in terms of like a basic need for like joy and wonder and like, you know, met loads of artists, like was, you know, introduced to lots of like really amazing ideas that were like incredibly seductive to me, people that were incredibly seductive, like artworks that were incredibly seductive, like all of this stuff. But then I guess there's two things there. One is that there's like this kind of very like kind of heartbreaking kind of split, let's say, where you have in an institutional context, you can actually invite an artist who might, I'm just going to make this up. You might invite an artist who will do like a whole 2-hour performance on the history of Marx and labor and blah, blah, blah. But then the next day, as a curator, you still return to your hierarchical job where actually the person at the top yields the most capital, even if it's just cultural capital out of all the work that you do, right? So for example, I would have been engaging in like a number and like a lot of like labor, which would then be credited to someone else who was above me, right? Because that's just how it works, right? And that's not even about money, right? That's like cultural capital, which I do think has a value, or certainly has an energy in the. It's certainly if paper money is just an abstraction, I think cultural capital is just as strong an abstraction, right? Okay, so there was that, like noticing that kind of relationship that actually there was like a real contradiction, right, in terms of the ideas that were being presented in the museum and the way that the museum was structured. Right? That's one thing. And then I think the other thing was noticing also, again, thinking about myself as a worker, noticing how starkly my experience of being at work was dependent on who my manager was. On a day-to-day life, my actual quality of life was deeply affected, if not controlled, by the relationship to the person who I reported to. I mean, I don't remember how old I was at this point. Maybe I was like 27 and like, you know, like breaking out in like mysterious hives and like all this other kind of stuff. And like, yeah, I mean, there were like a number of health metrics that were really, I had a lot of like joint pain involved. So it wasn't, my body was literally trying to tell me this is not okay. So then there's this very kind of like almost heartbreaking kind of like crashing down of reality of like, I used to say towards the end of that job, you know, we might as well be selling forks. I had come from before I decided to like, you know, quit what was my job and like move to London and start study art history, this like completely like romantic thing. You know, I was like, I definitely had a sense of myself being like in a job, right? But then I like did this like super romantic thing of like, oh, I'm gonna, and this is what I mean about how it's very dangerous, this idea that you should do what you love, right? Because then I was like, oh, let me go do what I love. Because at that time, when I had a, let's say, a regular job in like another industry, I was like going to museums on weekends. I was like, you know, right? So then it's like, oh, let me like do the thing that I like to do on weekends. Let me just do that all week. And then I successfully did that and realized like, oh, this is a job like any other. Like we might as well be selling cutlery. No offense to anyone who sells cutlery, right? But like, you know, but it's just about this thing, about this myth that art is different. Everyone, please remember that the arts in many ways is an industry just like any other, or is part of industry, produces industry, creates value for other industries. And you know, it's not that the government doesn't know that, because they celebrate that aspect in so many reports as to why it would make sense for them to pour so much money into something that is not, strictly speaking, income generating, right? Because culture does produce capital. Okay, fine.
So you were a key holder at May Day Rooms, which is in London. Can you just explain what May Day Rooms is to somebody who might not know, and your relationship with it?
Shout out to May Day Rooms. So May Day Rooms basically is an archive. First and foremost, that's my understanding, is that first and foremost, there's still an archive, will always be an archive of movements, of resistance. They hold a lot of material, for example, in relation to the Wages for Housework movement, which is one of the things that I appreciate them for so much. They also, I don't know if they still are, but at one point they were host to June Giovanni, who runs the June Giovanni Pan-African Film Archive, Pan-African Cinema Archive, sorry, which is a collection that this amazing woman has amassed over a number of years of films from across the African diaspora, like kind of worldwide. And they also are, they provide space for like a number of groups to meet. At the time, I was a part of a publishing collective called PSS, and we were key holders. Anyway, so basically, I used that, we used that access also to allow a group of POC artists who were mostly working in film and new media. I think that happened because I think film, again, going back to this thing where like this kind of like very long unspoken conversation about how much wealth you actually need to maintain being a painter, for example. You know, film and new media and performance practices is like something that people can do a little bit easier without having a studio. So, you know, obviously, because of the number of wealth disparities that there are in the UK, you, I think it makes sense that many at that time, Black and POC and queer artists were working with film and new media because that was something that they could do just with their own bodies or with very little equipment or, you know, whatever. So anyway, we were meeting there and other places. May Day Rooms was one of the places that we were meeting, and people were like presenting work and, you know, like talking about their work and having dinner and like building community and all this other kind of stuff. And we were trying to also make it like a really like kind of intergenerational vibe. And so we tried to like have everyone there from like BA, someone who was like studying their BA, all the way up to like, let's say, artists who were in their 50s or 60s or whatever. And actually, it was through those connections that we met Nowhere, which was the analog film nonprofit in Bethnal Green. And that led to things that became Not Nowhere.
Yeah, we'll come to that in a bit. Before we get onto that, I wanted to ask you, so we've touched on how art is sort of used by capitalism as a sort of productive industry, but in your opinion, is art useful for kind of political organizing, the left and working class struggle? Because that is something that people, you know, there's sometimes a bit of contest or like conflict, or whatever the right word is, about where people will be like, you know, oh, well, you know, why are we doing art? Well, maybe we should just be doing pure organizing. Do you have an opinion about that?
That's a good question. Oh, that's such a traumatizing question, Kayla, because I think something that has always really like bothered me is that I think there are a lot of organizers who feel like art is like the source of liberation, and I do get it to a certain extent, but I think for me the liberation is more in the misuse, right? So I can certainly see how being facilitated to draw all day as opposed to whatever else you were doing would be liberatory in that moment for that person in a quite a contextual nature. But I don't think that drawing itself is liberatory or cannot be liberatory on its own. I think the liberation is more in like this kind of this misuse or this dancing or this flexibility between things than in the thing itself. So, okay, I actually feel like art is maybe the arts, I think, is a very useful channel for the redistribution of funds. I do think that is true. And I do think in our current day and age, I do also think that the arts industry is maybe one of the channels that is most open for the processing of any type of something that might be called reparations, right? I think it's also, let's say, our cloak to collect reparations from the matrix. Let's imagine a sculpture where actually, because of the nature of how cultural capital is accrued, you could charge £20,000 for something that you worked on for 5 minutes, right? Like that can happen. And I actually feel like depending on who that person is and what that £20,000 is for, then yes, I think damn well we better charge that £20,000 for that thing we worked on for 5 minutes, right? And that's what I mean about reparations from the Matrix, which is actually, that's a phrase, reparations from the Matrix, comes from my fellow co-op worker, Daniela Valls-Jen, who is an amazing poet and performer and everything else. So we know that actually this thing of like operating outside of capital is like a distant dream, and we're just out here trying to mitigate it and like not die and trying to like create space for other people and blah, blah, blah. Is like the fact that you can charge £20,000 for something that you worked on for 5 minutes, yes, is a violence, but I think it's one of the tools that we have to use.
Maybe a critique, or not a critique, but sort of a pushback or a challenge on that is that is there not an issue with that idea that that tends to favor kind of individuals, and unless we're organized in, I don't know, a collective of some sort and are approaching that, what might be called financial domination in a way that's like kind of collective, it's just kind of benefiting an individual, and that is redistribution. But, it's slightly less effective, essentially.
Yes, great question, great challenge, great pushback. This is why I feel like I agree with you 100%. I agree with you. That example kind of only works as a liberatory force if there is a collective that is kind of like receiving that reparation from the Matrix, right? I'm certainly not suggesting to any, young Black woman sculptor, for example, who might be listening, is that your ability to collect 20K from a West London gallery is inherently political on its own. That would be, for example, why a co-op. That would be probably why I would recommend that any artist, and also maybe as a place where we can and actually should contextualize, from my perspective, what artists we're talking about when I'm speaking about collecting from the Matrix, which goes back to this thing about like, redistribution and like who it's for. And like, yes, I think for me, it is really important that Not Nowhere be, not necessarily that we be read as a queer and POC owned cooperative. It's like what I want you to understand about why it's good, quote unquote, that Not Nowhere is a queer POC cooperative is not just because queer and POC people are involved and included, quote unquote. Like anybody can include Black people in anything. We've seen that. That doesn't do anything, right? Because then basically all that happens is you just basically indoctrinate and ingrain loads of problematic like assimilatory politics into these quote unquote marginalized groups, right? Which again is violent. There's a term which again I love, which is called predatory inclusion, which comes from someone called Kesu Park. And I feel like that idea has been incredibly like useful for me in understanding like why it's not enough and actually why it's actually detrimental, this like ravenous impulse that I feel like a lot of like UK organizations have to diversify and to include marginalized groups. It's like literally all you're doing is assimilating people into something that's going to just basically help them learn how to subjugate others. Like I don't want that, right? What I'm trying to say is like if you're thinking about it from a context of the quote unquote marginalized, whoever they are, I guess I would say that the arts is the only thing that I have found where people are willing to redistribute, really willing to redistribute rather than just include. In terms of like thinking about your kind of co-op listener, your white middle class ideological man, right? I do not encourage British co-ops to try to include more POC, but like, can you actually more aggressively redistribute to POC, like with actual like hard money access and resources? Like, give something for free. Like, give all, like, literally, give something for free. You know what I mean? Like just, which is not charity because even charity is not free, right? Give with the expectation that it's going to cost you. This is maybe very abstract, right? But, for example, like I feel like there's this way in which when we're trying to like form solidarity across different like social positions, there's this idea of like, yes, I want to help. I want to include. I want to like build connections. but it always falls down at the point where that person who's trying to make those connections sees that their position is going to be sacrificed. And again, we're yes, I am talking at the level of abstraction. Literally sacrifice yourself out because you believe that this redistribution thing has to happen.
I don't think that's abstract at all. I think a lot of people struggle kind of bouncing in between those kind of like more charitable, learnt behaviors and trying to be more redistributive, but like struggling.
But I think there's maybe just like a different thing about being comfortable with the idea or being like motivated by the idea that privilege is something to use and not apologize for, you know?
Yeah.
In this context of like wanting to, of being on the left, of being radical, like, right? I feel like actually one of the things that we're doing to each other on the left is making people who are privileged feel like they need to apologize. Right, rather than encouraging them. Like, I'm not really interested in trying to ask someone from who has privilege to apologize for it. It's like I want them to feel like they can use it for the good of the collective.
So, if you're enjoying Punch Card, then please consider supporting us for as little as £1 a month. The only way that Punch Card will continue to stay independent from advertising is if listeners fund it. To set up a contribution, please go to opencollective.com/workerscoop/projects/punchcard, and the link will be in the show notes. Cool. So yeah, I'd like to move on to talk a bit about Not Nowhere in a bit more detail now. Maybe we can speak a bit about the sort of the origins, how it came about, and maybe touch a little bit more on what it does.
Not Nowhere has a few origins. So I guess one to speak about the machines and the equipment. So much of the collection of cameras and editing equipment that we steward comes from the London Filmmakers Cooperative, which was active in London from the 70s. Also, very interestingly, my understanding of them, I don't know if this is completely correct, but just of like looking through the various ephemera that we've had access to, is that my understanding is that that cooperative was for the most part based on volunteer labor. That's very interesting to me. Also, in terms of like how London was different, who was an artist at that time in London and their ability to work for free and blah, 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 which goes back to the conversation we've been having. So that's one origin. And that equipment was then, my understanding is, went to what is now Lux, which is still in operation as a distributor, and also to an organization called Nowhere, which was a nonprofit that was based in Bethnal Green, which was run by Brad Butler, Noor Afshan Mirza, and James Holcomb. Noor and James are still also involved in Not Nowhere at the moment. They like teach workshops. James is like helping us to consistently like repair equipment. So that's one origin. And basically what that connection was is like, this group that I mentioned before that was kind of meeting informally. One of the people that we invited to come attend those sessions was Noor Afshan Mirza, who basically made this connection about, they were dealing with like an eviction situation in Bethnal Green and needing to, I guess basically like close operation for various reasons, but wanting obviously the equipment to kind of continue. They also had an unrealized dream to turn Nowhere into a cooperative and gave us the idea that formulating as a cooperative could be a good way to steward this equipment. So that's one. So I guess there are a few origins there. One is the London Filmmakers Cooperative, one of those is Nowhere, and then one of those is this like informal group, let's say, of like my generation and younger who were meeting and organizing and building community around this kind of peculiar position of like being a new media artist in London in the contemporary late capitalist era. So basically, we entered into a process called novation, which is a term that I didn't know anything about, but which is a legal term which speaks to the transfer of physical assets between one incorporated entity to another. Like, this is how you play with infrastructure, right? Because there was this transfer of physical assets, as in like literally the cameras and the editing equipment being passed between Nowhere and Not Nowhere, there was basically an argument made that actually the Arts Council grant should be considered another physical asset because there's no way to actually access, activate the equipment without this grant. right? What the process of novation allowed us to do is to actually have a channel opened to where we could then apply for the grant ourselves, right? It didn't necessarily give us the grant straight away. So then we did an Arts Council application and we were successful. And yeah, that's how we got the money. One thing I want to say here is the amount of money that we have that either nowhere or not nowhere has received has basically not increased in any real substantial way kind of since 2008. It certainly was a thing that allowed us to start. It certainly is a thing that allows us to guarantee regular work to a small extent, which is more than nothing, right? For a number of people. It obviously guarantees that we are able to provide, again, a number of programs, right? But it also, I guess, their mission is that we would become so self-sufficient that we would no longer need their money, right? And that's why the money will never increase, right? And that's also our mission for different reasons, right? And so I think that if you imagine on day one, we were 100% reliant on their grant for our operations and our activities. I think right now we're somewhere at like 65 to 70%, maybe even less, maybe 60 to 65. Maybe eventually when all's said and done, this co-op will be a very interesting kind of case study for people to look at in terms of can you actually run an arts industry, run an arts institution with another economic model, which is not either a commercial gallery or a nonprofit, like kind of government granted institution.
And can you explain a little bit more about Not Nowhere's economic model that would help them to move away from being heavily grant funded?
This thing about Not Nowhere being a case study for how to get off of grant funding, that's definitely my hope. That's my vision. It's not feeling like a kind of light switch moment. Where we're at now is that we do equipment hire already. We're building an eco processing darkroom in our space. So, for example, we have a machine called the contact printer, which there actually is not another functioning contact printer publicly available in the UK at the minute. If you were a filmmaker working with analog, you would have to go to Berlin to get, right?
So, I mean, what's the kind of timescale for that?
The lab is not going to take that long. The lab will be open this summer.
Yeah, in terms of the sort of like using the grant money from the Arts Council in a sort of financial domination sort of way and doing things that would be considered, radical or to progress whatever causes you think are important, like Not Nowhere thinks are important. Like, is what are the Are there kind of practices that you're doing apart from teaching people about the analog cameras and stuff, which you're able to do facilitated by that money?
A concrete example is our former treasurer Sally runs a basic budgeting workshop. I think that workshop is like literally amazing because not only does that workshop address, actually how to put a budget together and blah blah, which is like would be a professional technical skill, but also I think working class people have not having financial literacy benefits the ruling class, right? So we have to talk about money, right? I'm trying to be more concrete for you.
Thank you very much. I do have one. We'll end on this question since we're running out of time. I wanted to ask you, what does Not Nowhere, I mean, you've spoken a little bit about what Not Nowhere does that no other co-op, that other co-ops might learn from, but internally, maybe in the way that Not Nowhere works, in the way that Not Nowhere operates in its kind of co-op in a more general term, so less specific to it being in the arts industry. Is there anything that you think that other co-ops can learn from what Not Nowhere has been doing?
This labor relationship does have physical and emotional costs. And I think that we are really good at kind of like holding that in the front of our minds. And I'm talking about like discussing things at the level of like fear and love and like pain and like frustration and like, you know what I mean? Stuff like that. Let's say I think we're good at acknowledging in the mix alongside with the kind of like hard numbers of like what we're being paid.
So why do you think that that's important that Not Nowhere does that, like holds that space?
Yeah.
And also because it is something that I've heard other people talk about in co-ops as almost like a negative. They're kind of like, oh, it's so, like emotionally draining, or there's almost like an expectation to be to kind of be everyone's therapist at like a small, I'm hyperbolizing a little bit, but some people find that a little bit too demanding.
I've been saying like the last couple of weeks, it's just like it's really hard being a body under capitalism. And we know this, that's why we're in co-ops, you know what I mean? But like to actually not be able to acknowledge that with the people who you are a body under capitalism in community with, I just feel like it would be extra isolating. Like also the sort of the point of working cooperatively as opposed to individual would be to battle this like kind of isolation and alienation. And I think acknowledging the kind of emotional toll, not only of the reason why we come to do this work, but that actually coming together to do this work doesn't absolve you from emotional labor. It actually requires more of a different sort. I think it's also just a way to kind of battle the alienation.
And that's the balance that Not Nowhere has to occupy.
Exactly. Exactly. That's a great place to end, Caleb, because that's exactly what's going on.
That's what I thought. Great. Taylor, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Caleb.
Thank you everybody for listening. Punch Card is released monthly, so look out for the next episode. If you enjoyed listening, please consider supporting Punch Card by going to our Open Collective page at opencollective.com/workers-co-op/projects/punchcard and starting a monthly contribution. If you are interested in finding out more about worker cooperatives, then check out workers.coop's website and don't be shy to send any questions you have or ask for support by emailing solidarity@workers.coop.